Paralympian. This is.
This what an intro, Elizabeth.
Blur. Paralympian blur.
The Clem and Em podcast with Clemmie Stewart and Emma Kell.
Welcome to another edition of the Clem and Em podcast with me, at C Stewart SHS.
And me, at Those That Can.
But those Twitter handles don't matter anymore.
No.
Why
they
not?
Are extinct, defunct.
They are, because we have a new one called at Clem and Em. And it is already a sieve of the most amazing tweets after a question that you posed. So why don't you tell everyone who didn't know already, what question did you pose?
Right, so this was a little bit random. So I was planning a training for staff and I just got a bit bored with myself. You know, do you ever just get bored with yourself?
Yeah,
do you ever
a lot.
Just sit and think, oh my God. So I asked teachers to tell me the funniest or most outrageous interaction they'd ever had with a parent, thinking I might get about six responses. And I was on my own in the house and I ended up howling into my tea, let's say tea, howling into my tea, scaring the cat out, because they were just hysterical. And we've got hundreds of them. Oh, and Jeremy Vine retweeted them as well. So, you know, claim to fame. You can touch me later.
Anyway,
so my favourite. Right, so this has been really hard. This one is from somebody called Puffin Teacher.
No, that's what I was going to do.
Oh, I got there first. Right, so Puffin Teacher writes the following. As an RQT, that's a recently qualified teacher, I was followed into the forest by a parent who didn't trust me to lead the forest school session. This mother was wearing camouflage clothes and a green beanie when we discovered her standing behind a tree watching us. So this is the ultimate helicopter parent.
But you know, I could see it happening. I could see it happening. We have a forest school. I've never seen a parent there, but I could imagine this happening. I love it. But it also sounds a bit like something out of a paintballing situation or something with these adults hiding behind trees. But I love it.
But my favourite thing about every single one of these is that someone else has come on and said, oh, we had a grandma do that.
Yeah.
Or there was someone who said, I was given a dead rabbit as a present from a parent.
And then someone else vetoed it.
And then I said I was a vegetarian. They came back with potatoes and leeks the next week. And then someone else came on and said, I was given a dead rabbit too. So
I
that's
just love
my favourite thing. Anyway, I'll let you choose the next favourite one.
My favourite was Chris Yule's. I'm not going to use the language in there. I will just have to beep it instead. My first parents' evening as an NQT and I had all my notes ready. The first parent came in, sat down and said, sorry if R's been a bit of a recently, but we've got a poltergeist and it's with his head. I didn't bother sharing his son's times table scores with him. I mean, what would you say? What would you say? I think you'd just be quiet. Let the silence do the heavy lifting.
It's random. I love it. Rachel says, child had needed changing into spare underwear. I think we can safely assume this is a primary setting. The next day, the dad came in, stood at the classroom door, and at the top of his voice declared, Miss, I've brought your knickers back from yesterday in front of all the other parents.
That is just magic. And again, you can imagine it. You can totally imagine it. My other favourite was from Mrs. B. Phone call home to a parent to share info about a behaviour incident, key stage 2 child. So you're already a bit nervous. It's a difficult conversation. Parent very supportive and very aware of all we were doing to support. I ended the call with, love you. I can just so imagine it. I've put kisses at the end of emails before. It's so embarrassing. You then have to send another one saying, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to kiss you. And then you have to say something in the car park because it's still really awkward because you don't want them to be too off with them. It's just so awkward. It's a minefield. Absolute minefield.
And the I love you one. Again, at least five examples of that. We've had examples of people bringing in their mother's favourite toy and look how it vibrates.
Well, I hate to say it, but I have had that experience.
Oh.
And I hasten to add very quickly, because I know a lot of the parents in my school now do listen to this. It was not in my current setting. It was not in my current setting. It was in another setting. And we did a show and tell. Year 5, which, you know, is a bit old for show and tell, but we were talking about toys, Victorian toys, and bringing in our favourite toys. Well, one of the girls in my class brought in her mum's favourite toy. And before I could get round to the other side, because it was a circle time situation, she was the other side of the classroom, 32 kids, it's quite a long time to get round there. She literally showed us all the different features of her mum's favourite toy. Things going up and down, beads, colours, whirring, movement. And all I could do was get a tissue from my desk, remove said toy, put it in my drawer and say, I'll deal with this. Then, of course, I had to make the phone call to say,
oh, no.
ex-child has bought in something. Never saw her again. Never came back in. Because it was a school with a lot of transition, shall we say, and transient community, I never saw her again. Never came to another staff meet, a parents meeting, anything.
Helicopter parent becomes ghost parent.
So, you know, end of term, Skip arrives, doesn't it?
Oh, bless just her. Popped in the I skip. Actually have a sudden just my heart goes out to her.
Oh. Just think if I hadn't called, she'd have just lifted, you know, and looked for it and never seen it again. That's a very difficult question.
I know I left it here somewhere.
Where could it be?
So I'm going to confess that I'm wildly excited about this particular edition of the Clarendon podcast, because we've got somebody here who I've been basically online stalking until she agreed that she was my friend under duress for about 3 months now after sitting next to her at a conference. And this is Paralympian medal winner and disability activist and all-round glorious human being, Elizabeth Wright, is with us today. We are delighted to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. It's... I've been looking forward to today for a very long time. Also the fact that I get to come down to London for the day, which is awesome.
So you've come all the way like down to London from Leeds just to see us?
Yes. Oh. Pretty much. Oh,
see, she is my friend.
So, tell me about the conference you met at. What tied you together in the first instance?
So it was, well, basically I nearly tripped Elizabeth up because I was carrying about 15 bags and trying to kind of lever myself into a chair. But appropriately enough, it was called Inspire. And then I think I had to follow Elizabeth. Oh, no, I didn't.
No, you went followed first. Me. I followed you. And it was after... who went first? She was
Karen,
that's right.
Karen Edge went first and I went into the toilets and locked myself in and then came out and said to the first person I saw, I was like, I can't do it. I cannot do this conference. But the conference was appropriate enough called Inspire.
Why did you feel you couldn't do it?
Oh, it was that imposter syndrome amazing. Thing.
Okay, and Karen was amazing.
She was amazing. I've also stalked her and she's also my friend. honestly. Karen was amazing and she just had the audience just, and I was just like, I can't do this. And I was so terrified.
Did she do well though, Elizabeth?
She did. Of course she did. Brilliantly. I still remember the story with the chair over the head. You were enacting it. It was brilliant.
Oh,
well, sorry. No, you're going to have to explain that.
It's a story about the only time I got badly injured at work, where a student had, two girls, a student had cussed another one's dad. And the first student had picked up a chair and tried to go for the other student's head, and I'd put my arm out without really thinking about it. Have you ever been injured at work?
Not really. I've walked into a few things. So teaching in a primary school, there's a really difficult problem with teaching in a primary school, and that is that all the chairs and tables are really small. And so you walk into things at really odd levels. And in fact, I remember going on residential last year with year three, and there was going through a tunnel activity at Hindley Warren, and I was determined to prove to the children I could go through the tunnels. Turns out I'm not designed to go through tunnels. But once you're in, you've got to style it out. And then as I pulled myself out, I managed to bruise all the way down my legs, but completely styled it out because I had promised I could go through said tunnel.
I've got images of you Winnie the Pooh style, sort of with your legs sticking out.
It wasn't attractive. There was no dignity, but it was great fun. And the children still talk about it, which is really good.
So, Elizabeth, tell us a bit about you and your school.
Okay. So, as I'm sure you can tell by the accent, listeners, I am not a local in any way, shape, or form. I am from Australia, from the land of neighbours and home and away and all that stuff. I grew up there, and I was one of the first children in Australia to actually attend a mainstream primary school as a child with a physical disability. Essentially, the education department desperately wanted to send me to a special school, and my parents were absolutely adamant that I was going to go to a mainstream primary school, the one down the road. And I ended up going there for a 3-month trial, sailed through this trial, I think definitely because we had the head teacher and the staff completely 100% on board in supporting me going to mainstream schooling. And, you know, after that I went to mainstream high school, and everything just worked wonderfully. I mean, I did fall down the stairs at both schools a number of times, just purely because at that point, You know, this is the 80s and the 90s. A lot of schools weren't specifically being made accessible for physical disability at that time. I think you see that obviously a lot more now with lifts and and things being put in schools. But back then I had to deal with stairs. And I can go up and down stairs, but I did have quite a few spectacular falls at school.
Can you just tell us for people listening at home a little bit about your disability and how it affects you? Because it's not cognitive, is it? So I'm trying to understand why the local authority didn't feel you were...
Yeah, I just think, so my disability is, technically it's called congenital limb deficiency, but these days a lot of people who have this type of disability, we call it limb difference, because obviously deficiency has kind of negative connotations to it. So I'm essentially missing half my right leg, half my right arm. I wear a prosthetic leg to be able to walk. And on my left arm, I'm missing a bone in my forearm, and I'm missing a finger, and my thumb and my little finger are joined together. So in terms of physical disability, when I spell it out like that, even I kind of think like, whoa, actually, like, I am missing quite a bit. But, you know, in general day-to-day stuff, I don't even notice that because it's my normal. You know, quite often I get asked by kids, what's it like to be disabled? And I just say to them, I absolutely have no idea because it's my normal. I don't know what it's like to have two arms and two legs.
Well, sorry to interrupt. Were your parents aware that that was going to be the case when you were born, or were there any indications that that's how things were going to be when you arrived into this good world?
The story behind that's a little bit, I guess, controversial in a way. So they suspected that something was not right. And this is my parents that I'm talking about, because multiple times the doctor would kind of subtly suggest that mum actually have an abortion.
Gosh.
But mum and dad, I mean, they're not, they weren't particularly religious or anything like that, but they didn't, for them as a couple, they didn't want to do that. So they went through the whole pregnancy thinking that something was up because mum was having more ultrasounds and there had been that subtle push for abortion, but not being told anything
by
the doctors. No.
Gosh.
And when I was born, they essentially knocked my mum out for 4 days. Like, she was high on drugs for 4 days after I was born because they were really worried about how she'd react.
Oh, gosh. So not for physical reasons then, just because... No. To keep her...
Yeah, because they thought she'd maybe panic or freak out. Leaving my poor dad the job of having to explain to family that this is what's happened. But you know what? From the very beginning, as soon as my mum came out of like her kind of drug-induced whatever it was by the doctors, my parents became absolutely kick-ass role models for me. Like, right down to the fact that, you know, within days of me being born, the hospital sent in a social worker to talk to my mum, who had two older children. So she'd been a mother. She knew how to be a mother. To basically tell my mother how she should raise me. And my mum and my dad basically kicked her out of the hospital room. We're like, basically, get lost.
Good.
You know nothing.
They obviously had to fight medical staff. They also had to fight whatever the Australian equivalent of the local authority is for you to go to a mainstream school. Do you feel they still have to fight anything now?
Yes. You know, for me, going to mainstream primary school was 35 years ago. And it astounds me, you know, on Twitter and stuff like that, I follow a lot of SEND parents and teachers and things like that. And I'm absolutely astounded that there's still actually a lot of the exact same questions being asked and challenges being made. It's not to say, you know, I've learned a lot being in this community on Twitter. You know, I used to definitely be like, well, I went to mainstream school, so every disabled child should go to mainstream school. I understand now, having spoken to a lot of these parents and teachers and stuff, that for some kids, even if you have a fully accessible school, it still might not be the best choice for them. But on the flip side, I think there should be that choice for parents if at all possible. So I think mainstream schools should be open to taking on kids with disabilities.
Are you finding though that there are a lot of families who are not being properly supported?
Absolutely. You know, people that I've spoken to that have talked about the difficulties that they've faced, and a lot of it is simply to do with funding. There's just not enough funding out there. And you kind of hear about, you know, whether it's simply having, you know, a loop in the school. So if you've got a child who's hearing impaired in some way, or, you know, being able to have slides or images that are big enough for visually impaired children to see, or even if, you know, you're installing a lift or not, right through to kind of the more extreme support that you need, where maybe you need one-on-one support. So you need a TA to come in and work one-on-one with a child, or a social worker, or whatever that may be. I get it. The funding just isn't there for schools. And I'm sure that there are a lot of schools out there that would love to be more inclusive and be able to have that. But I think parents and schools, I would say, are constantly fighting to get that funding that they need. And it's just not there. And I think, you know, for me, I've always thought of education as it's a human right. It's a human right that every single child, every single person should have access to education, and that includes disabled children. Yet, you know, I'm hearing stories of children also coming down to behaviour, being excluded for 1, 2, or 3 years from school. They are missing out. They're a human being and they're missing out on that fundamental right for education.
So in terms of disability support, what do you think the main factors are? Is it lack of training for teachers? Is it social stigma? Is it schools just thinking we're so pressured we just can't cope with this on top of everything else? What's going on? Or is it I don't know, just it's too complicated, they can't contemplate it?
I think it's a bit of everything. Certainly, you know, there is still a lot of stigma out there around disability and different types of disability. I mean, it sounds awful to say, but there is a hierarchy in terms of disability. A lot of people are surprised when I say that, but you saw it. You know, one thing I think we haven't mentioned yet is I was a Paralympic swimmer for Australia. I was a Paralympic swimmer for Australia, and even on the swim team, there was this strange hierarchy in terms of disability.
Can you just explain that a little bit more in terms of, God, it sounds really awful, but who sits at the top of that hierarchy? How does it sort of filter down?
It's, you know, I don't want to offend people by saying this, but it is a reality. And I think a lot of parents out there would agree, especially when it comes to funding. And even when you look at schools and inclusion, you'll find that probably physically disabled kids, especially ones maybe with disabilities that haven't impacted them that much in terms of whether it's cognitive or physical ability to access the space, that they're at the top of the pecking order. They get first, you know, invite or first inclusion kind of thing, because I think for people it's like as the disability perhaps gets more complicated, it just becomes harder for people to actually create a space that is fully inclusive. Sure. And when I talk about inclusion, it's not just the physical space but also the attitudes that people have. So you know, I mean, I've experienced that myself. I've had people come up and speak to me as if perhaps, you know, I'm not cognitively understanding what they're saying.
How does that happen often?
It hasn't happened particularly recently. Not to that extent, but for example, a few weeks ago, I was in a farm shop and I misheard what the lady had said, and I was like, oh, excuse me, can you repeat that? And she kind of looked at me as if like, oh, and then she kind of said it a little bit more slow. It wasn't as obvious, but, you know, it's still, I don't know whether it's me just picking up on stuff and perhaps misinterpreting it, but you have to think I've had a lifetime where I have experienced this, and it does make you suspicious to a certain extent about people's intentions.
It is also lack of knowledge, I think, and going back to schools, for instance, you know, I know a lot of teachers I've worked with in various different schools who want to be entirely inclusive and fair and give every opportunity to every child, but often there's just a complete lack of knowledge and therefore a lack of confidence about how they can best support a family or a child, and certainly an absolute fear of inadvertently offending or hurting yeah. when that's the last thing they want to do. And there's clearly a lot of work to do with that.
Oh, inadvertently offending or hurting. Can you tell us the one about the weaving? Tell us the story about the weaving.
Oh, yes. So I experienced definitely what you're talking about, Clem, in yeah. school, when I was in school. You know, I had teachers who were amazingly supportive and actively working to include me in every level and weren't afraid to do that. And then also had teachers that excluded me, not being maliciously excluding me, but perhaps because of ignorance or naivety around yeah. my disability, not understanding what I was capable of. And there was a teacher in year three who was like our craft teacher, and every Tuesday afternoon we'd have craft at primary school. And this teacher would, you know, or this particular week, this teacher had announced to the class that we were going to do weaving. And she handed out kind of weaving boards. I can't remember what they're called now, yeah. you know, like the weaving frames or yeah. whatever. And like balls of this amazingly brightly colored yarn. And, you know, for a kid that age, you're just like, wow, all these colors, they're amazing. I want to play with them. And then she very surreptitiously slid in front of me a picture to color in and some pencils. And I come from a very crafty family. So my mum was very crafty. All her cousins and my cousins are all very arty and crafty. And even at the age of 7, my mum's cousin actually taught me how to knit. So, you know, I'm sitting in this weaving class looking at all these other kids doing something I knew I could do,
yeah.
but I didn't know how to express this frustration to my teacher. So I would go home and cry and complain to my mom that I can't do weaving. Like, why is she not letting me do this? And this went on for a few weeks until eventually mom just got sick of me coming home in tears on a Tuesday afternoon. Went up to the school, asked to speak to the teacher. The next week, guess what? I got a weaving frame put in front of me.
Your mum.
And
yarn. Yeah, we haven't really talked much about your parents.
Yeah, unfortunately, mum isn't with us anymore.
Oh,
sadly. So, I mean, you know, she was absolutely, you know, the best mum I could ever have wished to have. But unfortunately, she died from cancer. Five years ago now.
Oh, I'm so sorry, absolutely flying.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Well, it's not something I don't go around yeah. announcing to the world. Yeah. Like, you know, my mom's not here anymore.
So what was she like? Well, because she was your champion, wasn't she?
Yeah. Both her and dad, but I think definitely mum was the massive champion in all of this, because even before I started school, so from when I was about 2 years old, she volunteered for the school canteen so she could take me up every lunchtime, and I got to know all the teachers and I got to know all the staff. And so eventually when it came round to the time where they had to go to the education department and ask to send me to the school, she had all of that school absolutely on board.
Clever.
With having me there.
Yeah.
So when she went in to fight with the education department, standing behind her was the head teacher and the kindergarten teacher and saying, yes, we want her.
She sounds amazing. So, right. So Paralympics.
Yeah.
Okay. So that fight. So you can't, not just anyone becomes an internationally recognized athlete. So how did this happen? How did you end up? Tell us about your medals first, and then tell us how you got there.
Okay. So I swam at 2 Paralympic Games, the 1996 Atlanta ones when I was 16.
I was 16.
And the Sydney 2000 ones, which were my home games.
That must have been incredible.
That was absolutely incredible.
That makes it sound like 16 wouldn't have been incredible. 96 wouldn't have been, I'm sure it was. But to do it in your home crowd must have been phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Atlanta, I won a bronze medal in the 50 metres butterfly.
Oh,
and in Sydney, I won a bronze medal in the 4x50 freestyle relay and a silver medal in the 400 freestyle.
That's amazing.
Incredible.
So butterfly's really hard.
Butterfly's easy. For me, breaststroke's the hard one. I can't do that. I'm absolutely rubbish at swimming breaststroke. So butterfly's easy, trust me.
That's incredible.
You just gotta pretend you're a dolphin. But it's all good.
I spent a lot of time pretending I'm a dolphin, but I still would sink.
I just really enjoyed watching you try and do that. That's the real downside of being a podcast that people can't see.
You are a dolphin. It's like one of those tapes which convince you are a dolphin.
It's like quite often, actually, when I've spoken in primary schools and I've spoken to the kids about, oh, butterfly, you know what butterfly is? And I just get this blank look of like, what? No. So I'm there standing up in front of all these kids, wriggling, looking like a dolphin and swinging my arms over to try and show them what butterflies
look like. So they thought you were doing Elizabeth, the worm,
don't they? Yeah, pretty much.
It's currently the image of a dolphin sitting in front of us. Yeah.
So how did you, so 16, you're obviously coming out of high school, are you, in Australia?
I was in year 10.
So was it the school that recognised this talent? Was it your family? Was it you?
It was me.
Sorry, I'm waving my arms around. Tell us the one about your brother.
What story you want me to tell.
What's your brother's name? Because I tell this story to anyone.
My brother's name is Philip.
Hello, Philip. Philip, I love this story so much. I tell it to anyone who will sit still for long enough.
Essentially, so being Australian, we grew up with a pool in our backyard. And we had one from when I was 2 years old. That was when we had it installed. And I loved being in the water so much. But, of course, my parents were very, careful about me being in the pool. So I remember what my floaties looked like. I had this bright red vest that was like, it kind of make you float along with almost like a hunchback, like you'd be like, whoa. And these big kind of armbands on to kind of keep me floating in the pool. And when I was about 5, it was just before I started school, and my brother and I, you know, in summer we'd spend all day out in the pool. My brother's 10 years older than me, so he was 15 at the time. And this one particular day, my brother just turned to me and he said, "I think you can swim without your floaties on." Goodbye. And I adored my big brother because he really accepted me and included me in as much as he possibly could. So I trusted him. And so we got out of the pool. He took my floaty vest off and my armbands off. And I thought we were getting back in by the steps, but he had other ideas. He decided to pick me up and throw me in the deep end.
Oh, my God.
You were 5?
Yeah.
And I'm assuming your parents were nowhere near to see
this. No. So, but
and you remember this?
I remember this, but the thing is, from that day, I didn't have to wear floaties in the pool again because
this is a don't try this at home.
Yeah, it's don't try this at home. Like I always tell kids, don't go and now throw your younger siblings in the pool. Like it might not have the same happy result as what I had. But, you know, I floated. I realized that I could float without my floaties on and I could doggy paddle. So, yay, no more floaties for me.
Yeah.
And I think that really started me on that Paralympic journey without me even realizing at that age that was what this was setting me up for.
Incredible. And then how did that then go from sort of regular swimming to then actually you're really quite good, you could represent Australia?
Well, I competed in my first competition actually in year 6 at primary school at the swimming carnival, and I actually came first, which shocked me. And it was actually in a breaststroke race. And like I said, I'm rubbish at swimming breaststroke. So how the hell I came first, I have no idea. But I did. I came first. And I think that really gave me the first idea that perhaps I was really good at this because I was racing against able-bodied kids as well. These were kids with 2 arms and 2 legs and I beat them.
That's incredible. How did they react?
I don't think they cared really. They were just at the swimming carnival having, you know, it's hot. It's really hot and they're just like, we just want to get in the water where it's cool. So I don't think they really cared. Whereas even then I was like, I'm going to beat you all. Like I had that mindset, like I'm going to beat you all. And from that I just, about a year later it was announced that Sydney had won the right to host the 2000 Olympic and Paralympic Games. So at 3 a.m. in the morning when that announcement was being made, I turned to my parents and said, I'm going to swim in those games.
Oh, and
they laughed. They laughed, but I nagged them for enough weeks that eventually they got me a coach and I started training for it. So
your parents are clearly incredible. I think were there teachers that played a role? So you are phenomenal. I mean, you are that determination, that that competitiveness, that lack of anger. I'm sure you, all that lack of bitterness, I think, that comes across from you. I'm sure there are times when you get furious with people, and I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of you.
Just laughing at Lenny the cat.
That noise.
Straight into Rav's bag for life.
It's not Clemmy trying to surreptitiously
quiz. Quality stream.
That's
the same determination. He's been inspired.
He has.
Through barriers, and here he is. What
about I've lost my thread now. Thanks, Lenny.
No, moving with the teachers that were part of that journey.
So were there teachers who played a key role?
Oh, absolutely. I think both pre-swimming and after swimming as well. You know, I had teachers in primary school who really encouraged me to really get involved in school and be included, like even in extracurricular activity. And I think Em, I've told you the story about netball. And Mr. Purs, I always thought that's an unfortunate name, Mr. Purs.
like a cat purs. But,
yeah, essentially. Yeah. I wanted to try out for netball one year, and he really encouraged me to do it. And I went and tried out for it and didn't make the team, but I'm not surprised, because I think if I had two arms and two legs or not, I'm absolutely terrified of balls being thrown at me.
It's a common fear.
I tend to duck. you know, I'm going to duck and hide or run away. I think a lot of it comes from the fact that when I was younger, I think it was in year three as well. Year three seems to be this notorious year. It wasn't a good year. I got hit in the head by a softball when I was meant to be fielding, but I was too busy looking for four-leaf clovers, and the ball came and just donked.
When you say softball, I'm guessing it was
quite not, hard, though.
They're hard. Right. Softballs are hard.
It's a misnomer. Right.
Yeah.
It's not nice.
Yeah, it's not nice.
I'm not a ball
So I think from then it's like anyone chucks a ball at me, I'm going to duck and scream. Yeah. And, you know, it's just not me. But, you know, he still encouraged me to do that. But then, you know, leaping forward to high school, you know, I think especially the head teacher, she was so encouraging, especially of my sporting endeavours. Mm. And I think she understood what it meant for me, because I was really shy as a child. And my parents often say that swimming really was the making of me, because it really gave me the confidence and self-esteem to have a voice and speak up more.
So for teachers listening, all I'm thinking is, and you've told me a few stories, you mentioned falling down the stairs earlier. Mm. All I'm thinking is risk assessment, assessment. On a practical level, how does it actually look to give, to strike that balance between not putting a child with a disability in danger and giving them the chance to try things out and flex their muscles, literally? Yeah. So you talked about going on tour with your school and things like that.
Yeah, like, you know, I was in the school choir, and they used to, you know, I've even sung in the Sydney Opera House, you know, even went with the school spectacular and sang there. And I think it's just trusting the child and the parents. For me, I think that's the biggest one. So teachers just trusted me. If I said I couldn't do something, then they believed me that I couldn't do it. But on the flip side, if I said I could do something or I wanted to try, then they would trust me and support me with that to be able to do that. So
that's so good. That is so important. I'm just thinking, and I'm not saying it's all about me, but when I'm in my head role and I look at how I work with my staff to try and make our school as inclusive as we can, the rule we always use is that they go by what the child says.
Yeah.
I've even got a girl down in year one who has some challenges, and we go off what she says.
Yeah.
When she wants to try something, we find a way of getting her to try it. We're in liaison with parents, but we do listen to them.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, what mistakes could teachers make in doing that or in trying to get it right? What can they do to get it wrong?
I think the impression I get is teachers, you know what, I totally understand that teachers have big love for the kids that they work with. You know, you want to make sure that every child, whether they're disabled or not, is feeling safe and loved in that classroom, that they're cared for and respected. But I think sometimes teachers can go a little bit too far with that. And I think even trying to support a child to achieve something, there's still a tendency to wrap them in cotton wool a bit. And I think this is just where communication is so, so, so important. I think you just got to be able to just trust that child, but also absolutely believe what they say and not make assumptions on account of perhaps you've seen them try something and it hasn't worked that way. Don't assume then automatically that that's it. They
never
can't,
try it again. Yeah, really yeah.
They point. Can't be involved. Is there'll always be a way. One thing I will say about most disabled people is that we're amazing problem solvers. Mm. And even as children, amazing problem solvers. I mean, when I was a child, before I got my first prosthetic leg, I discovered that I could move faster if I nicked my brother's skateboard and laid on it and zoomed around on it. I figured that out myself. So even as a child, like a disabled child will be able to figure out ways for themselves to do it. And it's just trusting that process with them and supporting it on that and not making those assumptions about their ability or disability.
And I think that's my biggest lesson from talking to you over the months is actually, if you're not sure, just ask. So if you're on the tube and someone seems to be struggling, don't just grab their bag. I'd like to think I haven't done that and knock them off balance in the process, but just ask.
Absolutely. Just ask.
However old they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've talked a lot about your time at school, and now obviously you go into schools, you talk to schools. If you were able to guide how schools were better at this in terms of educating children, so not so much teachers now, but actually the children, so the next generations that we're bringing up through the ranks, what could schools do better to make this world a kinder, more empathetic, more understanding place towards people with challenges?
You know what, it's interesting you've said that because actually earlier this week I was at a school near Birmingham actually delivering as part of their mental health week. Lenny's back again.
Lenny's back. He wants his own mic.
He does. He wants to be involved. He wants to be in all of the chat.
Included.
He wants inclusion well for cats everywhere.
Come on, Lenny.
I was at a school near Birmingham earlier this week, actually for their mental health week, and I ran a whole day of workshop. It was an all-boys school. I was with 13, 14-year-olds all day running disability workshops. Wow. And it was the first time that I'd really come across a school where the teacher who'd booked me said, I actively wanted to have a day on disability for these kids. We've never had it before, but I think it's so, so important. And what really amazed me was how successful it actually was and how willing they were to listen. And these are 13, 14-year-old boys. We all know what 13, 14-year-old boys are like, right? And it was a very diverse school, so boys from a lot of different backgrounds. And I wasn't quite sure, you know, culturally how a lot of what I was going to say would go down. But ultimately, at the end, the last part of my workshop, I was talking to them about how they could be a better ally for disabled people. And before I showed them my list, I actually asked them, can you tell me how you could be a better ally? Guaranteed, at the end of every session, at least five or six of those boys put a hand up, having listened to what I'd said, and came up with absolutely brilliant ideas that I was mentioning on my list already that they didn't know was going to come up, how they could be a better ally. So I actually think it's whether you're having a mental health week or through the PSHE program or whatever that may be, make sure you include an element about disability.
What kind of things did they come up with?
You know what, the best absolute response, and I will really point this one out, so much so that this boy got a house point for his answer. It was amazing.
He put his hand, big.
Like, even his teacher who was in the workshop at the time, she was working on some stuff and she actually stopped and listened to me. You could see the look on her face like,
I love that. That moment when your student says something lovely, you know, you're like, yes.
That's mine. That's mine. He's
pretty
mine.
Much so proud. What he said was, he said, you should, I'm going to be paraphrasing here because I can't remember his exact words, but he basically said you should raise up disabled people's voices and only speak for them if they can't speak for themselves.
Oh my God.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I made an assumption earlier, and as our lovely producer says, assumption is the mother of all mess ups, but he didn't use the word mess. I'm sitting here worrying about this now. I said you're not a particularly angry person, but I imagine there are some things that do make you really angry. Or are there? Because I made an assumption, because I like to pretend that we're BFFs forever, but we haven't known each other for that long.
You can be a BFF.
Yeah, but I was first.
You are first. I'm just riding for the back of you.
Saying. Hashtag.
Hashtag BFFs.
I'm banning BFFs in my school at the moment, so I probably shouldn't say
we're all friends. GFFs. Right. Now I've lost my thread again.
It was a really good one.
Is that being angry?
Angry. So what makes you angry?
You know what? It's really interesting. I've had a really interesting discussion the other day about anger and about embracing that angry voice that I think we all have to a certain degree. Because when I was younger, it's one thing, you know, my mum was a great advocate for me growing up. But once I started speaking up for myself, I think my mum was very afraid of confrontation and anger. So she used to say to me, please don't be angry. Like, please stop being angry about this stuff. So I actually suppressed a lot of that for a very long time. And then it's probably more recently that I've actually started to realize when I've seen that it's not just about me, but it's about all of these young kids that are coming up behind me who have disabilities, who are going to come into this world that, as far as I'm concerned, it's improved slightly for disabled people, but we're nowhere near to equality or opportunity for disabled people to thrive and flourish in the world. And I've realized that makes me angry. Yeah. And that's what I want to change in this world. If I can leave a legacy of some kind in this world, it's that the kids coming up behind me are going to have way more opportunity and inclusion and acceptance in this world than I've ever had. So that's, you know, it's that that drives me. Mm. So when I see kids being excluded, that makes me angry. When I see adults being excluded, that makes me angry.
And you respond by being a speaker, by speaking out.
By being a speaker and a writer. With some of the stuff that I've written lately, I'm amazed that I haven't had people kind of really pushing back at me. But I think what I've realized is that you have to be challenging to make people stop and think, because a lot of this stuff around disability, exclusion, attitudes and stuff like that, it's not intentional. People aren't intentionally being mean. In fact, a lot of the time, as we talked about, you know, asking before leaping in and helping someone with a disability, it's about kind of, you know, that kindness can then end up being an unkindness. So it's about educating people and challenging the stereotypes that people have and kind of, you know, these ideas that people have about disability, about what you can and can't do or who you might be because of that disability. And I think if you challenge, that's what makes people stop and really go, oh, okay, you know, I'm gonna try different next time.
And you and I recently had a conversation about role models. Are there many disabled role models for children out there, or is that?
You know what? It's growing and it's getting better. And you know what? I think CBeebies did brilliantly quite a number of years ago, where they employed, of course, Kerry to come on, who's limb different like
there
me.
There were complaints, though, weren't there?
There were complaints.
Based on what? Complaints based on what?
Oh, well, it would give their child nightmares to see
I don't want to see it while I'm eating my breakfast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long ago?
This was only like, what, about six, seven, 8 years ago?
Literally mouth hanging open.
But that happens. I think a lot of people don't realise that this happens. When I talk about some of the reactions I've had from people towards my disability, and a lot of people are quite shocked by what people have asked me, what people have said.
This is just reminding me of something awful. So there's a children's theme park, for want of a better term, down in Hampshire. And my mum took my little brother there quite a long time ago because he was quite little, with a bunch of other mums from school. And it happened to be the same day that a range of children with lots of different disabilities were there. And one of the mums that was with my mum went back to the ticket office and demanded her money back because nobody had warned them, and I'm using their words, not mine, that they were going to see disabled children. Mm. And the worst bit, if that's not the worst bit, was that the ticket person apologised and refunded them the money.
No.
And at that point, my mum just walked out and A, never went back there, and B, never spoke to that woman again.
Yeah.
I think this is it, because I think Clemmy and I, one of the many things we've got from, we can both be quite naive and we can assume that everybody
is kind
is essentially
and lovely
kind and nice and lovely and wants to be accepting. But
it's just shocking. And it's not, if children grow up around those attitudes, they will not be any different unless something fundamental happens at
school.
And
it's very true. You know, I'll be really honest here. I have been in a number of schools over the years where I've had young children come up to me and say to my face, I pity you.
Jeez. How old would you say?
10, 11, 12.
So what do you say?
I get very frustrated because I'll often say, please don't pity me, because I don't feel sorry for myself. I don't pity myself. But quite often they'll just say to me, oh yeah, but I pity you. Like they keep on saying it. Ooh. And it really frustrates me because I know that that attitude is probably not coming from the school. Yeah. It's coming from home. And it's really frustrating because I know that nothing that I have done that day is going to change that child's mind.
Mm.
It's like you need more of a social or community-wide kind of education about disability and
I can imagine if you came to my school, you would get asked a lot of questions.
Well,
and how do you find that? Because I know my reception kids, they ask some horrendous questions of all of us. Say, why are your eyes so tired today, Miss Stewart? Those sorts of questions. How do you respond, or how do you find that, or what's your answer to that?
You know what, the thing I find with most kids is that they're just curious.
Yeah.
And it's like when I'm out in public as well, like I get asked a lot of questions in schools. But also when I'm out in public, you know, quite often kids will be like, mummy, mummy, or daddy, daddy, look at that lady's arm.
Yeah.
Or look at that lady's leg. And quite often the parents will shush them and try and drag them away. And I'll just go up to them and say, do you want to ask me about my arm or about my leg?
Okay.
And they do just want to ask, like, well, what happened? Are you in pain? Why did this happen?
Mm.
And once you just explain it to them, kids really can be the most inclusive people on this planet, because they're just curious. Yeah. They want to know, well, why do you look different to me? Yeah. Oh, okay. Are you in pain? No. Okay. That's fine. You're my new best friend.
Yeah.
Let's go play.
Yeah.
You know, it's – and I actually think we as adults have a lot to learn from the way kids
It
can
needs
be
to be normalised, doesn't it? Because knowing, so I've got a couple of children in my mind right now who probably say to you, where is your arm? Is probably where they would start.
Yeah.
Then they would ask you why, and then they would ask you who your favourite member of Little Mix is.
Yeah.
And it would just go off in a completely different tangent of equal importance in their
exactly.
mind.
Exactly. I mean, quite often when I have Q&A, it'll start off, firstly with stuff about my disability, and then suddenly it's like, what's your favourite colour?
Yeah.
What's your favourite food? Do you like pizza?
Yeah.
Or I will get, my uncle, he had an accident and he had his leg in a cast for 2 months.
They love
and
it's an anecdote.
Wow.
They love. And at least that was slightly linked. Mine would just tell you that, you know, they have an uncle that has some and rides a bike. And then you just have to go, okay, great. Yeah. Any more questions? I am going to be asking you shortly to come to my school. So I'm just laying it out for you now. You know what you're going
to
be getting.
Just to be prepared.
Exactly.
I've got for that. Sasha at home is going to kill me if I don't ask her two questions.
Yeah, yeah.
So Sasha's 10 and she wants to know, what's your prosthetic limb made of?
Okay, so my prosthetic limb is, there's essentially two elements to it. The socket bit is made of fiberglass, so it's quite tough but light as well, so easy for me to use. And well, actually, I should say there's three elements, because then there's the bottom bit, which is metal. It's stainless steel, so you know, it's kind of all protected and stuff like that. I do have a knee joint on there, so I'm able to bend the leg. And then I do have a foot on there that's made out of kind of a rubber material. So
thank you. And her other absolutely crucial question was, can you swear with your three fingers?
I can.
Show us.
Show us. And we have photographic proof, so I can go like,
yes.
That, or I can go like that.
Oh, yeah. She can do
she's
the one
well.
Finger or the two.
Two
Sash.
Flair.
And
actually,
we've got
flair.
A photo of you.
Exactly.
A photo of you. A photo of
just
her.
For you, Sash.
Just for you, Sash, because that question was burning.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Okay.
So the question we always finish with is, if you were to be a teacher.
Okay.
What would you teach? Now, it can be a normal curriculum subject, or it could be something that's never been taught before that you would come in and teach. So what would you teach?
You know what? My background, so my first 2 degrees at uni were in art, and I've always loved art.
Two degrees.
Art. Yes, I've got three.
I've got three. The imposter syndrome we were talking about earlier is really kicking in. Let's talk about your 3 degrees.
Yeah, to invite her.
Get her out. I've literally done nothing with these 3 degrees, but you know what? It's like, I think I'll always be one of those perpetual students. I'll just continuously want to go back to university.
Keep achieving. Yeah.
So,
yeah. One of those.
Yeah. So my first one of those, exactly.
I tell I'm struggling with my master's at the moment.
So I can be art. A cheerleader in the background.
Yes, like, I need that.
Yeah, my first 2 degrees are in fine art, and I've always loved drawing and art and being creative and stuff like that. So honestly, I think I'd want to go into school and teach art.
Amazing.
And I actually think, you know, I know there's been a lot of talk about the arts kind of disappearing a lot from schools, mm-hmm. especially high schools and secondary schools. And I just think, you know what, it's so important. The arts, music, mm-hmm. drama, all of that stuff is absolutely crucial to developing the whole child. And you'll have kids that are going to your school that were like me, absolutely rubbish at maths. You know, we could do the whole growth mindset thing and say, well, you know, you might not know it yet, yeah. but I'm like, no, I'm just never going to be a rocket scientist yeah. or a mathematician or anything like that. You can put as many yets after it as you want to. It's yeah. not going to happen. But I loved English and art and all those kind of subjects. And for me, it's so important to keep those subjects there because for those kids that maybe aren't as academically inclined, those are the subjects that they're going to thrive under and build their confidence under. So you have to keep them.
And what kind of teacher would you be? I can actually see you as a teacher, actually.
I'm looking at a contract.
You've got those eyes which could pierce the soul as and when required. But what kind of teacher would you be? What kind of temperament?
I think I'd be a little bit strict mm-hmm. because when I think of myself as an auntie, I'm an auntie to six kids and now I'm a great auntie. I've got like...
Are you?
Yes, I'm a grantee, as my sister likes to call me. A grantee. And my brother's name's even better. He's a grunkle. I love that. So, and I've always been like a little bit strict. So I have rules mm-hmm. that I like to keep, but it's always because of the kids' safety and yeah. stuff like that. I want them to be safe. But I'd hope that I'd be a cool teacher, like someone that they could confide in and be able yeah. to come and, you know, if they've got some issues and they want to a bit of support and help and be a cheerleader for them, I'd want to be that kind of teacher.
And if you need to swear at them, you can.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. With my two fingers. Yeah.
I love that. Well, if you ever decide to become a teacher, come my way. I'm having you.
Oh, that's nepotism.
Thanks, Clem.
I don't care.
Nepotism, Clementine Stewart.
Minimal HR process, maybe, just come in.
Maybe at primary school, though, I won't give them two fingers.
No, maybe not.
I think I'll avoid swearing
maybe
with my fingers.
It could happen. Oh, this has just been the most amazing, refreshing 4 to 5 minutes of my life. I've so loved listening to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. Oh. It's been an absolute ball. I've loved it.
You've been brilliant. Thank you for coming all the way down from Leeds.
Yeah. That's all right. Serious. And can I say thank you to my friend who did come down with me, has been absolutely patient sitting here beside me, probably rolling her eyes because she's heard all these stories before.
She's been riveted throughout. She's only checked her phone a few times.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's been a ball.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
So much to think about, but I think the one thing that I'd like to hone in on a bit is the idea of when to help, how much to help in a school setting. So for teachers listening to us, they're thinking, okay, that's great. I should let this child do what they say they want to do and give them their freedom. And it's reminding me of your talk on trampoline parenting. Yeah. But if a child says, please let me hang off those ropes, and then there's a horrific accident, you are, as a school, potentially liable. So where do you find that balance? And what do you think? You're a head teacher, you're the one who gets the chop if the child does fall off the ropes.
When Elizabeth was saying that, I was thinking, oh, this trampoline parenting, which is really exciting. But I think you can only really use that approach when you know that child inside out and back to front. And it's that relationship. It's knowing the parents, knowing the child, knowing the boundaries. Because even with our children that are able-bodied, some think they can do a huge amount of things, which their PE team will be very quick to say they can't, or vice versa. And it's just knowing just how far you can push them and let them do stuff but in a safe and measured environment, yeah. because you have to be realistic. But I loved Elizabeth's guidance there. Just listen to the child.
Yeah. And I think this comes back to my current soapbox is there's no excuse not yeah. to understand your children's needs. I think we've got lost in this maze of data and targets and KPIs in many schools. And actually just sitting down with the parents, with the stakeholders, with the carers.
Yeah.
With the other teachers and making yeah. sure that you know what that child's needs are, that yeah. somewhere written down is what that child has said
yeah.
about what they are happy and able to do and what they yeah. fear and what they need a little bit of help with yeah. and that everyone has that information. And yeah. this is, I mean, I think Elizabeth talked about is communication.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And what I certainly anecdotally I've always done when I've been presented with a child coming to a school whose needs I do not have enough knowledge about, I ask. I get the parents in. I start by saying, I want to be able to help your child as much as I can. Tell me what their needs are. Help me understand how that impacts on their day to day. And then I will tell you if I can meet those needs yeah. because it's so important that you are the right person in the right place doing the right things and never assuming that you might know it or thinking you have to pretend you know it all.
Yeah.
No one does. Yeah. Just ask.
And no one expects you to. And yeah. that's what I love about Elizabeth. If you ask her what she can and can't do, from cutting onions to
yeah.
to holding a fork to everything else, she'll explain to you and she'll show
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
And I think, well, she would probably argue that most disabled people, if you ask them, they'll tell you. And she talks yeah. about stopping people in the street when she does need help and just ask it.
Yeah.
And they might look bemused for a second, but if she wants to borrow their shoulder to get down the hill, yeah. the cobbled hill, then she'll ask.
Yeah, I thought she was really realistic like that. And I think the other thing that really stood out for me was, I wrongly assumed she'd say all disabled children need to be in a mainstream environment. And actually, that's not what she said.
That's not what she was saying at all.
And I think that's really powerful that actually it's not a one size fits all approach. And it again goes back to that point. It's based on the individual and knowing that child. And I thought that was a really pertinent point. Mm. When I look at certain examples of children I've supported in my career, they have had such a personalised, tailored provision put in place for them. Is led by the child, but then scaffolded by experts. So I'm thinking of a girl we had a few years ago who had major challenges in terms of physical ability. And she had the most incredible tailored PE plan that was planned by my PE team in liaison with parents, with teams from Great Ormond Street, occupational therapists, that we just made sure that although we knew what she wanted to do, we then had experts saying, yeah, she can do that. But with all the rule in the world, that is not going to happen. It needs to look like this instead. And so in the most broadest terms, she was following a normal year six PE curriculum, but with the highest level of tailored approach to make sure that she could do it at her level. And it meant that she was fully included in every aspect of that PE lesson.
But the risk is that if that communication isn't there, that yeah. child, I'm imagining scenarios. Obviously, I can't talk about specific children or specific contexts, yeah. but scenarios where, let's say, the other children do help the child up onto the trampoline because the child is jealous and wants yeah. to get on the trampoline. And then there's a horrific accident. And that is always the, and we know that, you know,
yeah.
that people will never teach again if yeah. if they were in loco parentis for that. Yeah.
And it goes back to your point then about that communication. And I think we again, as a school, are so honest with the other children in that year group to say, this is what this child can do. This is what this child needs support with. You as responsible friends and colleagues need to understand that. And they need to understand their responsibility too yeah. in supporting their friend to thrive and flourish at school and be sensible. And in fact, you know, some of the most sensible year groups like that are actually down in reception in year one. They are yeah. so sensitive to the needs of their friends and seem to get that situation just right.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it's like at a teenage level, I must admit. But yeah. you're the secondary expert, not me.
Yeah, I mean, again, in your head capacity as a head teacher, you know, yeah. we know that schools are struggling with catastrophic lack of funding.
Yeah.
Does the kind of support we're talking about have to cost money?
Gosh, that's the million-dollar question. As someone who runs an independent school, I will hide from behind the barrier as I answer this. What I've found in my experience is the parents that shout the loudest and are able to take the local authority the furthest in terms of procedures and policies get the most.
Yeah.
And that terrifies me, and it sits very uncomfortably with me. Again, I mean, I last taught in the state system in 2014, and there was a funding challenge there. Mm. But in the specific instances of children who had really quite complex needs, we did have everything we needed for them. I don't think that's the case anymore. And I think some of those fundamental, I suppose, structural changes to your school, yes, that does come down to funding. Expert advice, yeah, absolutely. Occupational therapists, physios, those sorts of things do all have a cost attached to them. But equally, some of the best teachers I've worked with go away and do that research, ask those questions, spend time with the parents, and that doesn't cost anything apart from time.
And decent communication doesn't cost anything either. And just listening to Elizabeth talk about her parents, who just sound incredible as advocates for her. And this is a question, I don't have an answer to it, but I do worry for children with profound needs, or not even profound needs, with needs which make fitting into the mainstream a little bit more challenging. The ones who don't have the parents who have the confidence, the education, the ability to research, the voice to actually be the difficult parent that gets things done.
Yeah, I would agree. And I would say that, you know, the parents that do have success at tribunal, the ones that have the expensive barrister. And again, having sat in tribunal against some of those expensive barristers, they are terrifying. You can see how you get to a point where actually they just get what they're asking for.
They get what they want.
Whereas when I look at the school I'm a governor of, there's no money for an expensive barrister. There's, you know, the parents don't have that ability to access that. And so I think the outcomes would be different if it even got to tribunal point. Often there's a sense of, well, the local authority is saying this, therefore that must be all we're entitled to. And it's so difficult. And yet equally, from the local authority perspective, there is only so much in the pot. Yeah. And that pot has got to go a very, very long way. I don't think there's a single person that works at that level who wants to fail children. But equally, there's no sort of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
I am wondering what Lee Elliott Major would have said about this in terms of social mobility, because you do worry about that Matthew effect and the gap just getting bigger and bigger. But I would argue that there are small significant things that schools can do in terms of prioritising individuals' children's needs, prioritising communication with parents, that really do make a difference.
And I think one of the benefits comes from things like clustering or being part of a MAT, that if you've got a wider network of schools, there may well be somebody else who has limb challenges, like that she was talking about earlier. There might be somebody else in a school local to you that have those same challenges, and therefore how are they supporting them? What can you learn from that school? Or there may be another child who has Down syndrome. What are you learning from that child? And just sharing best practice, that is also free. It is free, and this is the best CPD I think you'll ever have.
Yeah. And I should say, Elizabeth didn't ask us to do this, but Elizabeth does go around and she speaks at schools and she loves doing it. So if any school does want to speak to Elizabeth, then I would highly recommend
her services. I'm signing her up. I already have, just as
you
left.
You employed her.
She's coming down to both schools.
She will never go back to Australia.
Well, no, then I'm going to give her an art teaching job and she's going to stay forever. But don't tell her.
You're evil. Right, you've been listening to the Clem and M podcast. And guess what, Clem?
What? Tell me.
We've got our own new Twitter site at Clem and M.
So exciting. The reason why that has been set up is to give people more of an opportunity to give us that feedback, tell us what they're interested in hearing about, suggest some amazing new people to interview for the podcast. So please do follow and engage with it. We cannot wait to hear your thoughts.
Keep the feedback coming.
The Clem and M podcast with Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell. Special guest, Elizabeth Wright. Produced by Rav Vadgama. The Clem and M podcast is a Those That Can production.